Welcome to the Morning Philip series, co-sponsored with the Bush Foundation and the New Mad Group, hosted at the Garage. The purpose of the Morning Philip series is to discuss philanthropy, civil society, and community. It is an opportunity to have a conversation with good people doing good things creatively and collaboratively. The format is a conversation, not a presentation, a dialogue, not a pitch. Two chairs, a table, and a community of interested people. And today we are pleased to have with us a husband and father, a public servant, an international recognized lawyer and lobbyist. The New Mad Group would like to extend a special thanks to Wes Brown, South Dakota Public Broadcasting for sound and recording, Brad with Brad Benham CPA, Russ with Brevity for coffee, Barefoot Dance Studio for the chairs, Wes, Sunny, Kelly for setup, Liz for photography, the members of the Garage co-working space for letting us use your space, the Bush Foundation, and everyone here for joining us on Monday morning at 7 a.m. For further information about what goes on at the Garage, please follow us on Facebook. Check us out on our new website, morningphilip.com. Live tweet today at hashtag morningphilip. And now with all of that, please join me in welcoming Steve Ryan, partner at McDermott, Will, and Emery in D.C. Steve, thank you for joining us today, flying out here yesterday, hiking around and spending time in the community yesterday. Really grateful for your time. I know you travel all over the world, and for you to take time to come out here really means a lot, so thank you.
Happy to be here.
Can we just jump in and talk a little bit about who you are and how you have gotten to where you're at in the career that you have? And if I understand correctly, this goes back to when you're a child. You spent the first half of your career in public service and the second half at a private firm. But that idea of public service was something that you were interested in because of some things early on in your life. Will you talk a little bit about that and how
Sure.
you became a public service?
Well, first, I'm a son of an immigrant. My father was born in Ireland, and my mother was first generation. She was the English speaker in her family. She was Italian. And my mother gave me a choice about my occupation. I could be a priest or an FBI agent. I'm sure there was a relationship to her intellectually why those two professions were the open ones for me. And even later in life, when I was an assistant U.S. attorney and an organized crime prosecutor and in charge of a large group of FBI agents, she said, I really am sorry you were an FBI agent. I said, yeah, I know, Ma.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what that's meant? No, I'm just kidding.
So I grew up in New York City. My father was a union officer, and we were deeply involved in the political system there. Unions were then the backbone of the Democratic Party, and unions were more important than they are now. But I remember when I was a little boy, Bobby Kennedy, who was the senator from New York in 1964, used me as a prop at a communion breakfast, put his hand on my shoulder and did his speech there. And that sort of, those sort of events like that had an impact on me. So I always wanted to be like Bobby Kennedy. And I'm not quite as handsome, and I didn't have the family money or the name. So he was an organized crime prosecutor. He took on Jimmy Hoffa in 1957 and went after La Cosa Nostra and the mob. And at age 28, I ended up doing exactly that, in part because if you don't know where you want to go, you don't end up getting there. So I ended up achieving my dream very early of being a federal prosecutor and standing up in court and saying, I represent the United States of America, which pretty big a thrill as a lawyer can get.
When you think of public service as a child and in your early career, and the difference between public service now and today, will you talk about first, how do you define public service, and then how has that changed over the last 40 years?
So public service, you know, includes the military, obviously, who serve and give the most, right? The most important public service is that. I have a son who's a captain in the Army, is a JAG officer and a reserve officer and has a day job, but is subject to call. But second, it's all of the federal or state local officials were elected, the bureaucracy that I was a part of, I was always a bureaucrat in the executive branch, in the judicial branch, and in the legislative branch. I served in all three. And so that idea of public service is you often get less salary, but you're compensated in other ways. You're compensated by the joy of learning and being given responsibility early that no one in the private sector would give you, but that's the benefit to you. The benefit is to give back to the taxpayers, to give back to the society, and I've always been motivated by that. Two of my three sons are already in the family business of the government. One's the deputy chief counsel of the Foreign Relations Committee, and another one worked at a previous White House for Vice President Biden.
You yourself served in the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. What was your role at the Reagan administration?
I graduated from law school. I went to Cornell and Notre Dame, and then I clerked for a federal judge for 2 years, and he was a former congressman. And a lot of us begin our legal career clerking for a judge. It's a wonderful halfway house between being a real lawyer and it's quite an honor. And so I enjoyed very much that relationship. He was my first big mentor in the law. And then I went to a big law firm for 2.5 years, enough to get the down payment on a house. And then I left to go to the federal government in the position. I was deputy counsel of the President's Commission on Organized Crime, which meant that I could go chase bad guys anywhere in the world, essentially. And so I was put in charge of labor racketeering because I had graduated from the labor school at Cornell and because I knew unions intimately. And I'm now persona non grata in the labor community because I went after the laborers union, the Teamsters union, and others. And then I also went after Chinese organized crime. I took down the leader of the Chinese organized crime group in Boston, the 14K group. I took down the Chief Justice of the Rhode Island Supreme Court, whose driver for his official post was the hitman for the Patriarca family. What could go wrong there? And so I did these other cases, including I went after the Outfit, which is the name of the family in Chicago. It doesn't have a family name, but it's the old Capone organization. So as a young lawyer, I was thrown into fighting maybe the best white-collar criminal defense lawyers on cases that were on the front page of the newspaper. And, you know, I sort of muddled through that. I didn't have the skills or the abilities that you gain in life. You know, like today, I'd be a much better lawyer in that situation. But that's how I got my experience, and at the expense of you as the taxpayers.
Well, and so will you talk a little bit about that? What was that experience like with the Outfit or the Chinese organized crime in Boston? Will you speak more about that and how that impacted you beyond the skills, but your perspective on?
So let me tell you how we caught the guy in Boston. I made a deal with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that cost me a week's salary in scotch, that they would wiretap all of the calls coming from known organized crime figures in Canada to the United States. And that's how we picked up the guy in Boston. And what happened was when Mrs. Thatcher turned Hong Kong back over, all of them left Hong Kong because in 1949, Mao had shot them all in Shanghai. So the ones who survived had been in Hong Kong, and then they dispersed around the world. And so this exodus of them was what we were looking at. It was a new development. And they brought heroin to our country from China. In other words, it was traveling from what's now Myanmar across China and then here. And unlike your usual La Cosa Nostra guy, if he got a kilo of heroin, he moved it about 6 hours after he got it. The Chinese would sit on it for 60 days to see if they're being followed. I mean, they're a much more professional organization as a drug trafficking ring. So I went after him. His name was Stephen Say, AKA the Sky Dragon. And any of you know the name Bill Weld? Bill Weld was the US attorney, and I was 28, 29. Bill was maybe 32, 33. So I walked into his office. I said, I'm gonna take this guy down. Can I do it in your district? Will you go to court with me, et cetera, et cetera? And he says, well, you look awfully young. And I said, hey buddy, look in the mirror, you know? And Bill's like 6'5". He's the antithesis of me, right? It's like, we are a Mutt and Jeff joke together. And but anyway, we did that case, and so he went to prison for a while, and then ultimately he received 6 warning shots in the back of his head from somebody, and I made sure I saw the autopsy photo to make sure he was dead, because he had said he was going to kill me, and you know, it was just better that he was there. So anyway.
And the outfit?
The outfit is so interesting because
in Chicago.
In Chicago, the Chicago family, all of the other families have a name, you know, the Castellano family or the Gambino family or the Patriarca family, all of them rooted in the convention of organized crime. And the Chicago family was most interesting because the guy I used as my witness was a man who was a little Japanese man who had been shot 5 times in the back of the head and lived and became our witness. And how that happened was he was in charge of gambling on the south side of Chicago and was convicted on a gambling beef. He got 5 years. And they said, well, maybe he'll snitch on us. So they just decided to kill him, even though he had spent his whole life working for them. So they're not quite the honorable people from the movie, if you know what I mean. Even though they aped the movie. The movie changed them. They all became, they wanted to be men of honor like Marlon Brando. And so he then testified against the people, the capo in that family, who had caused him to be hit. It was a 22 caliber revolver or automatic with a homemade silencer, and the silencer slowed the bullets up. So when he was hit, it blew up the back of his head, but he didn't die. And he could think very well. But do you remember when the Apollo program, when they'd send a signal to the moon, it took about 4 seconds to get out and then for the return? So when I'd ask him a question in public, it would be, there'd be like, doo, 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 and then the answer would come back, right? And I had to tell people, you know, you need to wait because the signal's going to be going around his head a little. His wiring had to change. And we have somebody who does neural work right in the front row. So that was interesting to deal with. So that was maybe the greatest job I ever had. I mean, it was like a living cocktail party. And I was made a probationary investigative trainee of all of my investigative agents. They really liked me because I was too dumb to say no. We'd go to trial on stuff that had been awaiting somebody who was willing to do it. And so they liked me and trained me. And they were men's men. I don't believe we had any women at that time, because they were like the chosen 2 from each, 2 from the New York PD, 2 from LA PD. I had 2 DEA agents, 2 FBI. It was like the Ark. And so we had very, very good people, or people the agency didn't want to see again and were very bad people. But anyway, that's the government.
So your service, your public service, then took you post-Soviet Union, after the Berlin Wall fell, you volunteered.
Yep.
You did a few things between. You did a few other things too, and we'll get to that. But you ended up volunteering post-Berlin Wall in 4 different countries, right? Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Russia. Will you talk a little bit about what your role there,
sure,
and why you volunteered to take on that from 93 to 96?
Well, volunteer is an interesting word because originally, you know, when you do these things for your government, the government feels that it can call you back whenever it would like to, even though I don't have a contractual obligation. So when they tell you, we think you're the right person for this duty, it's very hard to say no, because what I've become in life is a success because of my federal career, right? Because of what I learned in government, that's enabled me to do very well in the private sector. So when the Russians began to leave the Baltic, the man who led freedom in the Baltic was the Procurator General of Latvia. Procurator General in Latvia, I had an ID, and if I showed it to people, they blanched. They went white, even after freedom, because it meant somebody was about to arrest you if you showed them those credentials. So the KGB told the Procurator General what to do, where in our country, the Attorney General and his lawyers tell the FBI what to do. It's a little different here, right, in many ways. And so I went and wrote with the Procurator General the Latvian criminal code to replace the Soviet junk that had been imposed on Latvia. Latvia was a European country, and they had had a European legal system until 1939-40 when they were overrun by the Soviets as part of the pact with Hitler. And it was a wonderful experience. The Latvian people are amazing people. They're amazingly beautiful physically, by the way. We felt that they exposed ugly infants on a hillside because everybody was uniformly attractive, men and women alike. But the Russians were resettling their soldiers there. And so we were trying to save Latvia. And so it was writing a criminal code. In Lithuania, my job was to teach the KGB agents who were Lithuanians how to do real investigations, how we really do things. You know, and they'd joke with me, you know, yeah, we pull out his fingernails. Thank you very much. So that was a fun assignment, working with agents from another country. In Poland, I worked trying to figure out who the judges were. In some European countries, judging is a profession, like lawyering. You get out of law school and one becomes a lawyer and one becomes a judge, which is a little peculiar for us, since the way we do it is you become a very experienced lawyer and then you become a judge. It's different. But we were trying to weed out the Stalinists among the Polish judges, and the Polish government asked us to come in and do judicial training, in part to get the impressions of all of us, which of their judges, you know, were gonna make the cut. And then finally, I did the first judicial training in Moscow. And going to Moscow, if you go to a Russian courtroom, there's a cage for the defendant. So you don't have that problem when you ask your witness, looking around the courtroom today, do you see the person who bugged you or did this bad thing? Well, he's the guy in the cage, right? So it's pretty easy. So those experiences, for me, were really important. They pointed up rule of law and how important rule of law is, which we take for granted here. We've always taken it for granted until recently, in a sense that rule of law will always be fundamentally what we are. We're the country with the greatest honesty in its public contracting, that we're the country where the Fifth Amendment right to a lawyer means something, that you can defend yourself, and the Fourth Amendment, that your home can't be invaded, and so by the government. So seeing that, you see your own country in a different way. So it was a gift to me, and my wife, poor soul, was left with two and then three little ones under five, and we still talk about my bad judgment in accepting those assignments. So there's always someone who's sacrificing that you can do a cool thing. My wife was a very skilled lawyer and worked at the Justice Department but had gone home with the children. So anyway, I still owe her for that.
You knew the late Senator John Glenn and worked as his chief counsel to the United States Senate Oversight Committee. Will you talk a little bit about that role? You called Senator John Glenn a hero.
Absolutely.
Will you talk a little bit about what made him a hero for you? Why do you say that?
So there's the public John Glenn that you all know, dedicated to his wife. You know, if you wanted to see a model marriage, the Glenns were a model marriage of genuine love and affection between them. Lovely family. But John Glenn was called a MiG-MAD Marine. He fought in World War II as a teenager, as a Corsair pilot, off a carrier, firing ground support missions for his Marines. He went back to Korea and did that and shot down two MiGs. And his wingman on eight missions was Ted Williams. The two of them flew together on eight missions. So that was before he strapped himself into an Atlas rocket and became the first American to orbit the Earth. But the reason he's my hero is his integrity. I worked in the Senate for him for 4 years, and I was his advance man in his presidential campaign. And I don't think there's ever a man of more rectitude, not a prissy rectitude, but of genuine rectitude and hardworking. So when we had a hearing the next day, like we did an investigation of Three Mile Island, and we sort of proved what really happened at Three Mile Island as opposed to the public myth about it. And he would read that notebook at night and come back with his opening statement that I had written for him, changed and underlined and everything. And I still have one or two of those that he gave me. I asked him to give them to me. And I treasure those things because he was an American hero. And his integrity is sort of a model for public officials, in my judgment. And you can judge whether other public officials live up to the John Glenn model, which would be very difficult.
Well, that leads me to the next question. John McCain, John Kennedy, John Glenn, all of these are flawed humans.
Yep. Although Glenn, I'm not so sure about the flaws, but the others, yes, they were all wonderful people, but highly flawed in some ways.
In today's world, can we have heroes? Heroes in the political world?
So,
what I get at, because people down so quickly.
I believe we come from a nation of heroes, by the way. I think this is a heroic nation. Our founding was heroic. The people who stuck their neck out and would have been hung to create a country, that was heroic. The people who came out here and busted this land open were heroes. My father, who drove a landing craft in World War II, and always felt that every day that he lived after that was a day given to him because 50% of his class were killed. We come from a nation of heroes, and we've lost nothing of that. When I look around at my son's generation, one of my clients is Rob O'Neill, the boy who killed Osama bin Laden, and I was his lawyer to get his book cleared by the Pentagon. The Rob O'Neills of the world, or the Captain Cassidy, who's a SEAL, who's now going to go up and command the space station. We still produce heroes. And there are heroes in your community who are taking care of a spouse who has multiple sclerosis, or who are doing things like Matt does for nonprofits and his work for Red Cloud, which brought us originally together. So we come from a nation of heroes. In the political system, it's much harder to be a hero, and here's why. The ghost of Senator Bennett and Congressman Crowley scare all the other members. Let me tell you who Bennett was. He was a perfectly good movement conservative senator from Utah, and Mike Lee croaked him from the right, who's the senator now, because he wasn't sufficiently conservative. And so from that point on, every Republican in a safe seat got afraid that they were going to get primaried. And now we have the same thing, finally, with the Democrats. Congressman Crowley was a terrific guy from New York, was going to be the Speaker of the House on his way to being the Speaker. And he got croaked by AOC, the young woman who's become such a hero. And now all the Democrats are worried about being primaried from the left. So what we've done electorally is we've narrowed the band because our Republicans are being drawn to the right and our Democrats to the left. When I was in government, there was a much greater group in between, like John Glenn, who was a perfectly good Democrat but would work with his Republican colleagues. There was Senator Inouye from Hawaii, who won the Medal of Honor, and he worked with his counterpart, Senator Stevens, who was a Republican and who had flown a C-47 over the hump in Burma. And those men, you couldn't separate them. We don't have those friendships and relationships in the same way now, and it's our fault. It's our fault as voters that we're not sending the right signals, that when people shut down the government for 35 days for absolutely no reason, we don't punish the people who do that. We say, oh, they're screwing up in Washington. We hate Washington. And you can't hate Washington. You have to decide who's responsible for the failures and hold them accountable. And John Glenn always did that. He held everybody accountable. His butt had been in a rocket with 360,000 parts, right? It was by the low bidder. And so, you know, there is responsibility. We're not squabbling children in Washington. We look like it. But some people are right and some are wrong. And we as the voters have to address that, I think.
We talk a little bit about this change that's happened that you've seen in your 40 years yeah. in Washington. You mentioned a little bit of going to the extremes in each party. Why has that been accepted, or what's really happened? Or we just speak more about that and your thoughts regarding that.
So there's a loss of collegiality. It's a loss of listening to the other person and trying to find common ground. And that's our fault as voters. Because if we send the signal, don't compromise, then they don't compromise, right? And so we're now in a system that's become polyamentary. In each election, if we look at whether the House, the Senate, or the White House turned over, between 2000 and now, there's only two elections where we didn't turn over one of those bodies. So the electorate has become volatile, right? Where in 2006, if Republican had been a dog food, it would have been withdrawn from the shelves because it was not selling. Its brand was very tarnished, right? But by 10, the Democrats had been thrown out, right? And so we've been oscillating. And if we had that map, the map shows why. We have a country that, I'll just hold it up for a sec. If you could see the color, that's all I'm asking you to do. There's a big, big red area. That's the rural America. It's the conservative America. And then there's the blue coastal or other regions, or maybe a swing district in this state of Native American voters. But we're two nations, and we're in equipoise between Republicans and Democrats not accepting each other's ideas. And the picture speaks to that, about where we are and what our values are. This one, let me show you one more picture. And again, I know this is, all I want you to do is take the impression of the picture. The red is counties that voted 80% for one candidate in the election for Hillary and Donald Trump's election. So if 80% of the people in an area vote for the same candidate, you all share values. We've actually begun to segregate ourselves. We live with people who reinforce our judgments. We listen to a media outlet that reinforces our judgments and don't listen to the other ones. And so those are the things that I think have changed. And most importantly, the members don't know each other. They go home on Thursday night, they come back in on Monday. They don't go to a barbecue and meet the children and wife of somebody in the other party. And they used to. They used to spend more time together with each other. They used to have poker games. And they used to have what we call prayer clubs. There was a senator that I knew very well who had a prayer club where they had either a spouse or children that were alcoholics. The members weren't the alcoholics in this case, although down on the floor every once in a while you'd see, you know, somebody steering not so well, right, after cocktail time, or Vespers as they used to call it. But if you knew about that club, and I knew there were 8 senators in that club, when one of the senators wanted something, I'd go to the other 7 members of that club to get a vote for him. I don't think that happens anymore, right? And so you can't call someone an SOB if you've met their children and their spouse. And I think that that's what's missing in Washington to some degree. But it's our fault. We have to take responsibility for it as voters.
So we're going to come back to this.
Sure.
But I want to go back a little bit. But we'll come back to politics before the hour is up. The way we've talked about your career is a lobbyist, congressional investigator, white-collar crime lawyer, and a cybersecurity lawyer.
Yep.
Will you talk about this package that you have become?
Sure.
As in your career, and why that's a unique set of skills that you've brought to this profession, and that has led to a number of different clients and work. We talk a little bit about why
sure.
those four are unique to have in one lawyer.
So I left government because we ran out of money. As you go into private schools and all of that, one government salary and 3 children and a wife who's home doesn't cut it. So my wife made the sacrifice of going home, and then I had to make the sacrifice of leaving government service, which was probably my highest calling. So when I left government, I formed a boutique law firm. Boutiques are like a law firm of 10 or 15 of us. And I was a named partner in the law firm. It's kind of cool, your name is on the door. And what I tried to do was to carve out a space that other lawyers weren't in. So because I was a congressional investigator, I then defended people who were called before the Congress in investigations. And sometimes that can be very hairy. So I'll give you maybe one or two examples of what it is to represent somebody now that I'm on the other side. I represented Eric Prince and Blackwater when they had the Mansour Square killings, when what happened was in Iraq, they were the security guards for the embassy and for people. So when the embassy people had to travel somewhere, they did it in a convoy with Blackwater. Well, one of those convoys was ambushed at its destination. And when you're ambushed at your destination, it means you're penetrated. It's not an accident, right? It was a deliberate enemy action. Enemy always has a vote. And in law, the enemy has a vote. My opponent always has a vote in what we're doing. And what happened then is the rescue convoy went out and secured the intersection so that the first convoy could get back. And then as people got close to their truck, they shot them to death. Because in Iraq, a car bomb going off 25 yards from your vehicle meant you were going to die. And those people who are all former Delta Special Forces SEALs, they weren't going to die that day. So they decided to shoot the people there. It turned out that the government has decided ultimately that was a bad shoot. But when we were dealing with it, I was defending that company about 30 days after the event in a congressional investigation with Eric, who is a very, his sister is now the Secretary of Education, Ms. DeVos. They're a very right family in terms of their politics. And so we were going into what is it like to be dealing with that. So that was a really interesting case. So I've had cases that you, my cases are on the front page of the paper. I recently, in the white collar area, had Michael Cohen as a client. And that started as a congressional investigation responding to the Russia allegations. And so if you're in a congressional investigation, usually the person's under investigation by the Justice Department or a state attorney general or the SEC. So that's what we call a parallel proceeding. So I do both. And so that work has been how I've made a living. Standard lobbying is real easy comparatively. Like a business hires you, you're supposed to stop a bill or get a bill through. That's much easier work, if you know what I mean. And I have great clients. I represent the Mayo Clinic. I represent other really important companies. I represent all the tax companies as a lobbyist. And so those are pieces of me. Of late, I have always been fascinated by cybersecurity and those cases, and I'm doing a lot of that because there's a lot of stuff. I just completed a fraud case where one of my clients was defrauded for about $10 million and got a judgment on that. And then 2 days after I got my judgment, the U.S. Attorney's Office in South Carolina indicted my opponent. So I'm still sort of on the cutting edge of working with government all the time, but sometimes I'm the opponent. And I'll give you one last case, and then Matt, you'll take me back, because I could tell stories. Some are true. most have a factoid of truth at the center. But I represented a Bronze and Silver Star Medal winner who was a Marine who worked in naval intelligence, who was indicted for a sort of rogue purchase of silencers that go on the end of AK-47s. And that case, the court appointed me as the attorney. So I still have my security clearance, and I do things like that. That's what I do as a lawyer. So I make a living in sort of a couple of different buckets where normally people only do one thing. Lawyers have become specialists. You know, you're a corporate lawyer, you're an intellectual property lawyer, you're a cybersecurity lawyer. Because I'm in Washington, I've sort of flitted around, and I do what I want to the degree that I can find a client to pay me for it.
That unique perspective, the history in public service, what I'm wondering is if, and what you were just saying, talking about politics and where we are in the political climate, I'm wondering when You and your wife, Lisa, have three children. What will the biggest challenges for them be, for your grandchildren be? When you think of politics today, the United States, and from the lenses you get to see as you travel around the world,
yeah,
and work with different clients.
So let's start with the world. The world is in turmoil because the pace of change has driven people to be afraid. And you see that in Brexit. You see it here in our country in how people are reacting by voting about cultural and symbolic and ethical issues as opposed to the issues about China and the Persians, Iranians and what they're doing, and the Belt and Road, and the issues that are going to be very important. So in 2050, 70% of the world's population will be living in cities with sometimes electricity, sometimes water, sometimes sewage, sometimes services, and sometimes not. We're going to live in an incredibly different world, right? In the United States, by 2040, we'll be a majority non-white country. Those sort of changes are profound changes. Can you believe what you read has become a problem for us, right? In terms of how do we get our information and everything. So the world that we're handing to our children and grandchildren, it's not as bad a world as we got handed in some respects, like the World War II generation got handed a far worse world. But there are parallels between 1930 and now. There are parallels between the sort of gilded age of the tycoons and now. And so we have a lot of things to work on. And I'm not sure we're working on them the way we should be. So if we contrast the World War II generation that for 45 years held containment against Soviet Russia and won that battle over many decades and over Democrats and Republicans, it was a consistency. We need to find more consistency in our political life to address that if our children are going to do. And how many of us believe now that our children won't make as much money as us, won't have that upward trajectory that has been, I think, part and parcel of the promise of America? Not everybody gets to do that, but a lot of us did. A lot of us are better off than our parents. And the hope is always that that will be the case. If we lose that hope, then we lose an essential characteristic. So those are the macro drivers of it. And then you can break that down into what do you got to do, mm-hmm. which is a more difficult thing.
You travel all over the world. Your work involves countries in multiple continents. You have been involved in the creation of rule of law for freshly minted democracies. How do you describe the democracy in the United States?
Well, we have a vibrant democracy. We're going to be okay. We've had bad leaders at different times. We've had good leaders at different times. We've had inept leaders for a long period of time in our history. But if we look at what Lincoln faced in the Civil War, what Franklin Roosevelt faced in facing Nazi and fascists in Japan, if we think about the challenges that we faced after 9/11, I think our democracy is probably essentially sound. I think people are arguing about whether it is essentially sound, but our political operation in Washington is not working well. And I think we all know that. And so the question is, how does that get fixed? And I think it gets fixed one step at a time, one bill at a time, one outreach at a time in terms of how the members of Congress and the members of the executive branch work.
What's the most important characteristic you mentioned when we talked about Senator Glenn? Integrity. What other characteristics are important for leadership? Leadership in general, but leadership in Washington. What are the most important characteristics?
So look, I am really good at government now, right? After all the training I got. When I was chief counsel of the Senate committee, I knew every department. I knew what was going on in every department because we were the oversight committee. I had 80 people working with me, looking at every agency. Expertise in government is important. And if we look at how we elect people, we elect presidents who have less time in government than the opposing candidate who has more time in government, generally, if you think about it and go back and look at it. We often are electing that.
Such as Barack Obama.
So Barack had less time than McCain.
He was a professor,
right?
Instead of,
yeah. Or he had been a senator for, a nanosecond, right? Donald Trump never served in government. And I think there's something you do learn in government. I think electing people who have not served in government, you get what you pay for sometimes with regard to their expertise. It takes a long time to know these issues, right? To have an understanding of how subtle some of the issues are, to deal with places in the world you've never been to is, that's a difficult thing. And so I think that's interesting. What's interesting too is if you look at whether a president's reelected, it's very highly correlated to whether there's a recession in the 2 years preceding that. So I'm not wishing anything on us, but there's no recession now, which would seem to say that this president, if you look at all of the other elections, there's, I think, one election in the 20th century where a president was reelected in the face of a recession. Otherwise, they lose, right? So, interesting.
Is the economy stupid?
The economy stupid is really the issue, right? It's always the issue. And that was the slogan of the Clinton campaign, but I think it should be the slogan of all. The economy is very important, but the question becomes, what's the long-term health of that economy? Where are we really headed? Not where the stock market is today, although it's been very good. Are we in the industries that we should be in? Is government supplying the science and technology that then the private sector can marketize, et cetera? Those are really important issues, and I think we should be working on those.
Do you suppose that an issue will bring the country together, or what will actually bring the political parties together in your mind?
That's a difficult question. So if you look at the Republican Party, it looks like it's in a death decline based on the choosing of what demographic groups will make up the party. Right? It's increasingly white, it's increasingly lower educated, it's increasingly rural, and if you look at where the growth demographically is, the Democrats are there, but the Democrats have a lot of trouble keeping their coalition together, right? It's a coalition that's very, very difficult, and the debates are very unattractive. They're fighting each other rather than potentially fighting the president. So our leaders don't seem to get it, right? They also don't understand that we want them to be from the get-it-done party. Honestly, do you really care whether they're Democrats or Republicans as long as they get it done for us? And so we have to demand that they're in the get-it-done party, and I haven't seen that movement yet, right? People are angry, and they vote negatively, but I'm not sure they vote positively.
Who, in your opinion, has been the greatest U.S. president?
Lincoln. Even though Washington is the indispensable man, the two of them I don't think any two men ever had bigger problems to deal with, but Lincoln saving the Union and ending slavery has to be the epitome of leadership, right? I think TR and FDR, a Republican and a Democrat from the same family, saved capitalism. They changed, TR with the Sherman Act and trying to reestablish some order in the Gilded Age, and FDR saving it. Did they blunder? Did they make mistakes? Yes, but they saved it. So those four, for me personally, John Kennedy, I think, is way underrated. And I'll just tick off the underrated. Established the Peace Corps, nuclear test ban treaty, didn't blow up the world as his Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to in the Cuba crisis. He literally had generals, wanting him to bomb, and he decided not to, right? He did some very interesting things in 3 years as president, and he gave us a sense of hope. He put us on the path that led us to land on the moon. So was he a flawed individual? Did he have integrity in his marriage? I'm not defending those things, but war hero. You know, I'm sort of drawn to that. I have a bromance with people who have demonstrated that they'll go in harm's way for their country, and then that turn to public life and are tuned to solving problems. Well, above ground nuclear testing, that was a pretty big problem that John Kennedy got rid of. And so, you know, I think he's underrated.
Is there someone you think would make a great president who has not run, not yet run for president?
So on the Republican side, I've always liked Rob Portman of Ohio. Worked in the cabinet, lawyer, White House counsel, good senator, Senate Finance Committee, a really good man. Take Rob Portman, I mean, he's truly experienced. He'd be a wonderful president. I look at the Democrats, I think some of the most attractive candidates are having a lot of trouble getting traction. Governor Bullock, because he brought people together, he's a Democrat who got elected in a red state. I find that very attractive. Hickenlooper in Colorado, a purple state, who did interesting things. But it's what's in people's heart, right? People were very critical of the second George Bush, that he wasn't an intellect, that he wasn't like his father, that he wasn't, but he was basically a good man. If anything has come clearer to us, it's the character of the leader, not just the policies that they're doing that should be important to us. So I loved John McCain. I loved him. Could he be harsh with his colleagues and do goofy things? Absolutely. I mean, I was there one day, he tore into another United States senator who was dealing with something because he wanted to go home, and that senator was delaying him. And it was like, whoa, you know, you don't talk to your colleagues that way. But John McCain loved his country and was a true patriot. And so on the Democratic side, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, I think, would have been maybe the best candidate. Of the people who are not running or are running badly now, those are the names that I think of. And you could supply others. There's a lot of really good people who are in government and work really hard.
Steve, what is the best piece of advice you've been given?
So Chuck Manatt, who was the chairman of the Democratic Party, was my boss at a law firm that I left my boutique and went to a 500 lawyer firm. And now I'm at a law firm with 1,100 of my closest friends. and in the 500 lawyer law firm, it was Manatt, Phelps & Phelps. So Chuck Manatt was the name partner. I gave up being a name partner. And I was his clerk, as we say. And he said, you have to give back to your community. And if you give back to your community, you'll do better. You won't know how you do better, but you'll do better if you do that. And I've spent a lot of my life trying to live up to Chuck's admonition. He'd come into my office and, Steve, we're going to be giving money this week to this thing. Your share is $1,500. And so, now come on down to my office and have a scotch, and that's all you're going to get for this $1,500. But my wife is a board member of the Red Cloud Indian School, and I'm here today because I'm a spouse of. I came to know Matt, who worked at Red Cloud as the fundraiser, and my wife worked on the Lakota Language Project to write down the Lakota language into a teaching curriculum with Indiana University, which she and Matt and others did. And so we give back to Red Cloud. I give back to Cornell. I had a scholarship to go to Cornell that I had a free ride. Like, I don't know how I would have gotten here if Cornell University hadn't educated me and made me who I am. And so we put a scholarship there for the Lakota people to go to Cornell. We're hoping that we can combine my wife's passion for that with that. So that's how I try to do it. And I try to get my juniors to do the same thing. And that was the best piece of advice I had, because I feel better about myself, even as I represent people, you know, who are so interesting.
So can we go there for a second,
sure.
Steve?
Sure.
So you represent you represent Republicans, Democrats, you represent people in your lobbying practice, criminal backgrounds, people accused of interesting things. Won't you represent?
So there are clients that I have not taken. usually because I go home to my wife and I say, this doesn't seem right to me. And she says, well, where would you sleep if you did it? Or, you know, you just sit there and you go, I didn't go to law school this way. Like, I didn't do tobacco. I could have done represented tobacco companies. I've dallied with pharma, but I haven't done too much of that. You know, you can't do everything anyway. I was asked to represent the Saudi bankers who were defendants in a civil suit about their connections to 9/11, and I turned that down. So there are things I won't do, not many, you have to have some limit or filter for yourself. On the other hand, I take difficult cases, and sometimes my law firm, I think, would prefer that I just take the Mayo Clinics and the Hewlett-Packards and the, you know, Caterpillars and the great companies of America or the, you know, that. And I've always lived a little bit on the edge. And it's been a really interesting experience doing that.
Can we go back to politics and America for a second? I'm hoping you'll talk about this idea of American exceptionalism. Will you define that a little bit?
So I believe we're an exceptional country, by the way. I believe we're a country of heroes, as I said a minute ago. But our exceptionalism comes from something different than what people think it is. It came from Roger Williams, who created really the doctrine of separating church and state. And I think that the seminal freedoms of our country, that we can bring in people who have different faith-based reactions or no faith at all, goes back to Roger Williams. And I would recommend to you that you read John Barry's book on Roger Williams. I love John Barry, and he's a great friend. And I think that American exceptionalism comes from those core civil liberties that we have, not by some God-given, God-inspired, but not God-given set of rights. And it's a constitution if we can keep it, not, you know, God isn't going to reach out and help us keep that constitution. We have to do it.
Thanks for sharing that. I find it interesting because I think Tocqueville, when he came over in the 1830s, first talked about the exceptionalism that you just spoke of, and it was Stalin that actually coined the phrase American exceptionalism, which is now much more in the political world what we're hearing people talk about. And do people really realize that it's actually you're repeating Stalin? And not the exceptionalism that you just talked about.
I think that's fake news, personally. No.
Well, that'll end it today. So one of the things that your interests are so vast, and it's led to these things that we've talked about. Theater is extremely important to you. What's your favorite theatrical performance?
So I'm on the board of the Shakespeare Theater in Washington. I grew up just outside of New York City and went to the theater all the time as a high school student. I created a club and made the high school pay for us to go to the theater. And I have never acted on stage. I only act in courtrooms or hearing rooms. But I love Shakespeare and the classical canon of theater, Ibsen, you know, Tennessee Williams, the things that have become part of the canon of classical theater. And so I am never disappointed when I hear a phrase in a play and you then hear that phrase and you know that it's passed into our language because it's the wording of Shakespeare. And so that's been an inspiration to me. And by the way, I've done good by being on the board of that. I've gotten to know all the members of the Supreme Court who go to our theater. So I got to know them as people. But no one will allow me to argue a case there. They only allow me in district court or the Court of Appeals. I never get a Supreme Court case.
How about literature? Is there a book you enjoy and recommend? I know you just mentioned one, but is there something else that you'd recommend for us to read?
This is something we arranged, by the way. Yeah. This is an arranged question.
And you have your notes. Glad.
So let me challenge you to read Barry's book, which I think is important. There's another book. And it's a law book, We the Corporations, by Professor Winkler. It's not a polemic. It takes us from the beginning of the country and the extension of civil rights from us in the Constitution to corporations and how that occurred. And it's a funny story. But it ends with Hobby Lobby and Citizens United. So it's right on the cutting edge. And if you really want to see how that occurred, not whether those cases are decided wrongly, which of course they are, read that book. Another one that policymakers have been reading in Washington is The Thucydides Trap by Graham Allison, which is the idea that if you have a declining power, some say the United States, and an ascending power like China, he went through the 13 other times there's been an ascendant and descending power, and most times, 11 out of 13, there was war. So an interesting book that tries to give us a historical background on the perception of where we are today. And President Xi has declared war on the United States. He's in a 30-year war. Read what he says. If you read the actual words of the president, he says we're in a 30-year war with the United States. So I always take my opponent by what they say and what they do, and that's interesting.
When you think back 39 years practicing, what's the biggest surprise?
It's always your friends who get you in trouble, not your opponents. Almost always it's because you did a favor for a friend and got yourself in the wrong place. And that if in Poland, they expected the defendant to lie on the stand to get off, and the judge was not allowed to increase their punishment because they lied. And I think we should bring that law here to the United States.
If you weren't a lawyer, what do you imagine you would do?
You know, I have no idea. I found girls and was never going to be a priest. I'm not that religious. My next career will be teaching. I'm going to leave the law relatively soon, and I think try and find a place. I taught 11 years at Georgetown Law School along the way, and so I think I have something to give back to young lawyers and to people. I'd love to teach at the Naval Academy or at the War College. I'd like to work with our military officers about some of these things, like how do you do crisis management, like, and give back again. So I have one more gig coming up, I think, I hope.
Would you ever run for political office?
Absolutely not. It's only for rich people. I'm a staff guy, very happy to be a staff guy. I always expected, by the way, to be the White House chief of staff, so I've fallen much lower than I expected. No, I'm only joking. I never expected that. But I would love to see great people serve, our children and grandchildren be inspired to public service.
Can we end with a story of George McGovern, the one that she shared?
So there are two people from this state who I got to know really well. One is Bill Janklo, who is your governor and a Republican, and a raconteur. I could listen to Bill for hours. I loved him. He worked with me. He was on the Mayo board, and we had a big threat to our hospitals, and he and I worked that together. I loved him. But George McGovern, the story of George McGovern's wartime service needs to be told all the time. He was a B-24 bomber pilot in World War II, and one day his plane was shot up. He had lost, I think, two out of the four engines, maybe only one. But he also had his landing, two engines. His landing gear was shot out, and he had to land flying into the side of a mountain on a field that was only capable of landing fighter aircraft, which had a shorter roll distance. And he balanced his airplane on the two wheels that he had. It was called the greatest feat of flying of anyone in that theater. And that's a man who then became very liberal, very different in his politics because of his wartime experience. But I used to ask him to talk about that. He'd say, I'd walk up and he'd go, no, I don't want to talk about it anymore. But you got to love the people who served our country in that way and then became political leaders, right?
Steve, thank you for joining us today, for spending time in the community yesterday, for sharing your thoughts this morning. Today, we have a piece of artwork from Black Hills Works, Susie Kappa Art Center, an art studio for artists of all abilities. We hope it finds a place on your wall and it reminds you of the time you spent in the Black Hills this week.
Thank you. You've been a great audience, by the way. Thank you very much.